All right, guys, so all right, we're getting to chapter 12. He's going to start winding down his letter now. So let's kind of remind ourselves, who's he writing to? He's writing to Jewish Christians, so that's why it's called the letter to the Hebrews. Jewish Christians who, this is probably sometime before AD 70 when the temple is destroyed. The church, which primarily is made up of Jews at this time, is undergoing severe persecution and from Jews, non-believing Jews in the Messiah, in Jesus. And so some of the Jews who believe in Jesus are thinking about just going back. It's easier just to continue in the old system, just go back to the old system and not worry about Jesus. And so the author has been, for most of this letter so far, been talking about not doing that. He's been talking about the superiority of Jesus. And so he kind of wrapped it up with, ultimately, if you decide to leave, there's no going back. Okay? Now, then he went into what was the great faith chapter, which was chapter 11, talking about those who had a faith in what was to come. Like, we have a faith in what is to come. We have a faith in Jesus, but in what is to come, okay? And how they held on. So now, after he wraps up the great faith chapter, he goes into chapter 12. He's going to talk about a realistic approach for us. Okay, so we're going to focus in on verses 1 to 11 today. All right, so let's first of all start off with verses 1 and 2. He's going to give an admonition. So here's what he says. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. All right, so let's take a look here. So first one, he's going to mention something that probably you and I have heard. I'm sure you've heard this, that we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Okay, you ever heard that statement before? Okay. Now, when you heard that before, what did you think that meant? Or what were you told that that meant? And how, and especially with regards to your everyday lives. Okay, so saints who've gone on before us. All right, that's good, John. Anybody else heard something more than what John just said? All right, angels around us, okay. Great cloud of witnesses, okay. All right, that's good, Tim. Anybody else? Anybody else have heard something different? All right, how many of you have heard this? That right now, the saints who've gone on before us are like in the spectator stands watching you. Have you heard that ever preached that way? The great cloud of witnesses are, they're looking down at the race of life for you, and they're witnessing you. You ever heard that? Huh? Yeah, they're you know, okay, that's another way of saying it, Tom. But have you heard that kind of statement before? I've heard many a message of preachers who will get up there and say, you know, that you're to endure and run the race because we've got this great cloud of witnesses that are watching us as we go on and do what we're doing. You ever heard something like that? Okay. That's not what it's talking about. Okay? So what is he talking about, this great cloud of witnesses? Well, he just told us about the great cloud of witnesses, chapter 11. Since we are surrounded by the stories, the testimonies of these saints, and I would say for you and I here 2,000 years later since that letter, of other saints that we have personally interacted with who've gone on to be with the Lord, We are surrounded by their witness of their faith and their trust in Jesus. Let us keep going on. Do you know what I'm saying? Let us. That's what he's saying here. Okay? So it's not that somebody's watching you, spectating on you. Okay? Because I actually think that when you die to go with the be with the Lord, you enter into timelessness. We leave time. You know what I'm saying? And so when it says that those who have died, when we are transformed in the rapture, we're all together, we enter into timelessness. It's not like, oh, well, on the third day of the sixth day of the month or whatever, the fifth hour, I saw George do this. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's not going to be that. You're not going to have a discussion in heaven with somebody who's going to say, hey, George, I saw you make that dumb decision. Why'd you do that? You know? No, that's not going to be taking place. What's the witness for me is for me to continue on in faith. Now, how do I know that? Because when you look at what he's saying in the text, what stirs us on? Stories of others who've done it, right? Stories of others who've accomplished it. Stories of others who lived the life of faith, right? Yeah, because what discourages us? Stories of failures, right? Don't even try that, Brad, because 50 other guys tried it and they all crashed and burned. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, you won't. That's not an encouragement. Okay, so let's take a look here. All right, let's take a look at what he's saying here. So first one. So the writer tells his readers that they are surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses. So you're surrounded by this great cloud of testimonies. Do you understand? Of testimonies, all right? Now, that's what it means. The cloud of witnesses refers to the testimonies of faith in chapter 11. So this is it. You are surrounded by this great cloud of testimonies. And I would add to it not just these testimonies, folks, but to the testimonies of other believers throughout the centuries and even in your lifetime. So would everybody agree with me? In your time in church, you have met people in church who exemplify faith. Would everybody agree with that? They may have been quiet people, but they exemplified a faith and a trust in Jesus, right? Yeah, so those kind of people give you encouragement, okay? They give you encouragement. All right, so now, I want you to notice now what he's going to do is with that great cloud, he's going to tell us to do several things here. He's going to tell us about this race that we have to do. So if you look at verse 1, it says, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely. So the writer is urging his readers to lay aside any weight of sin that hinders our lives. Okay, so let's just be honest. Do we all sin? Okay. Now, I'm not going to ask you to answer this one, but I want you to think about what I'm asking. Do you have some pet sins? Don't answer that. I know the answer. What do you mean pet sins? You have sins that you fall in continually. You have sins that hinder your spiritual life. They're weights that hold you down in the race to move forward. This is what he's talking about. We all sin. But there are sins, there are different levels of sin in your life. There are sins that you constantly succumb to, engage in, whatever, that hinder your spiritual life. They weigh you down for the race that you have to do. Now, here's what he's saying. He's not saying examine it. We already know it. He's saying lay it aside. Do something about it. Run the race. Do you know what I mean? Run the race. Think of that sin like a chain that has been chained to your leg with a 50-pound weight on it. How far are you going to run with that? You know what I'm saying? You can run, you can walk, but it's going to be, you'll be kind of tugging it along as you go. He's saying lay it aside, take it off. Get rid of that thing that's hindering you. Okay? We all, and is it going to be different? Yeah. My sin that I need to lay aside is different than whatever the sin is in Brad's life or in Rob's life or even in Jean's life. Do you understand what I'm saying? We all have our things that hinder our race. Lay them aside. That's what he's saying here, okay? Lay them aside. He urges his reader to lay aside any weight of sin. Okay, now, what does he do? He tells us the reader is called to run with perseverance the race that is set before us. You're to run with perseverance. Why? Because it's not going to be an easy run. Everybody knows that, right? When you run this race called life as a believer, is it going to be easy? No. No, there's all kinds of things that can happen. Not just your weight of sin that you're dealing with, you got to lay it aside, but stuff happens to you that you don't have any control over, right? But he's saying, run that race. Keep pressing on, period, with endurance, okay? Now, here's what else he says. Here's the focus. Here's what you got to keep your eye on. You got to keep your eye on the goal. If you're going to run the race, and let's be honest, it's a marathon. If somebody said, hey, George, let's do a 50-yard dash, I could probably say, okay, I'll do it, but I'll do the 50 yards, but I'll be tuckered out or whatever. I'm not in fit shape. But if somebody said, George, it's a marathon, forget it. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm not going to do that because I'm going to peter out at some point, have a heart attack, pick me up on the side of the road, take me to the funeral home. But I mean, just, you know, forget it. But he's saying here, look, it's a long race. So keep your focus. So here's what he says, okay? When you look at verse 2, here's what he says. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. All right, so here's our focus. Number one, look to Jesus. As we run, we're to look to Jesus. That's kind of makes sense, right? So I told you the race, is it easy or hard? Okay, because stuff happens, right? So when you are having stuff happen in your life, where's your focus? On yourself, John says? Oh, on the problem, on the difficulty? Yes. Yep. It's anywhere but Jesus, right? And we know from other scriptures when we talk about dealing with problems and suffering, who are we to look to? Who are we to have faith in? Who? Jesus, right? So he's saying, look, if you're going to run this race, the long term, you look to him. Look to him. Why do you think, okay, have you ever heard the statement that when we go to be with the Lord, he's going to look at you and he's going to say to you, well done, thou good and faithful servant? That's not just going to be about what you did for him here. Because sometimes we think in terms of what we achieve for Jesus, and he'll say, well done, Rob, you good and faithful servant, you did all the stuff that I wanted you to do, that I planned out for you. No, no, that's not all of it. It's going to be, because when you go to Revelation, it's going to be about overcoming and enduring. Do you know what I'm saying? Enduring to the end. It's holding on to your faith. And so in the end, it's like, attaboy, you made it. You held on. My good and faithful servant. And then notice what he says, enter into my rest. Why do we got to rest from? The race we just ran. Did you understand what I'm saying? The race we just ran, the life that we just had with him. So as we run, we're to look at Jesus. Now, here's what his nature and actions are. If we look at verse 2, the latter part, a couple things I want you to see here. First of all, Jesus is the one who pioneered our faith and perfected the way of faith. Okay, so when we talk about that, look at what it says there. The founder and perfecter of our faith. So the founder of our faith is Jesus. It isn't you. Who's the one who gave you faith? God did, right? And it says he's the what? The perfecter. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean? Okay, so what you may not know is I have a great wife who makes apple dumplings. And she made some for the Thursday night group, okay? And we shared some with others. And Lori, I think, has perfected that. Perfected the apple dumpling. Boy, I'd like to have Lori's apple dumplings. You're not going to get any because I'm here, so, okay. All right, so anyhow. Over the years, she has perfected it. Why? Because she knows what to do. It just comes natural. The person who perfects your faith, is it you? It's Jesus. Now, let's stop for a moment. He's the one who perfects your faith. Is that encouraging or discouraging? Okay, all right, so why is that? Why? Okay, John just kind of shared because we can't. Why is it encouraging to you? Talk about you. If he's the one who perfects your faith, because let's be honest, do we struggle with our faith? Do we say, Lord, I don't have enough faith in here? Do we say that? Do we say things like that? Okay, so, but if you read something like this, that he is the founder and the perfecter of your faith. And remember, he just talked about faith for a whole chapter about these folks, which, by the way, when you look at the list, they had their issues, didn't they? Okay? But they're in the great faith chapter. Okay, so here's what I'm saying. He's the perfecter of your faith. How's that an encouragement to you? Okay, all right, so how does that encourage you day by day then? Because the race is difficult. Do you understand what I'm asking? Because there are times when you feel like throwing in the what? The towel. Tell me to run a marathon, boop, I'm going to throw in the towel. You know what I'm saying? Because I don't have faith in myself. But the reality is that I need to look to Jesus, who is the one who gives me the faith to trust in him and to run the race, right? See, this is the encouragement, okay? It's not about you, all right? It's not about you. Now, so why did this happen? He endured the shame on the cross as he kept his eye on the throne he would be given. So he's the example to us. He endured the cross, but he had his eye on the glory that was to come. Now, the implication of that is you and I, as we're running our race here in this life, keep our eye on the goal, which is Jesus. No matter what you endure here, because the glory's coming. Do you understand what I'm saying? The glory's coming. All right, so now he's going to give us a plea for realism in verses 3 through 11. So I want you to notice what he's going to tell us to do here. Because of this admonition, this encouragement he's given us, I want you to notice with me now what verse 3 says. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as the sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Okay, now we're going to talk about discipline here. I don't know if I want to talk anymore, George. Let's call it quits. Okay, let's talk about this, okay? So first of all, look with me at verse 3. The reader is called to think about the suffering Jesus endured. You and I need to think about what Jesus went through. Because who did he go through it for? For us, okay? So it's not just something, oh, well, it's all taken care of. Jesus took care of it. No, no, think about it. What did he endure for you? Okay, now, here it is. This will help the reader to endure in the midst of his suffering. When you think about what Jesus endured, it's going to help you in the midst of your suffering. Okay? In the midst of your suffering. So, he's going to now, when he gets to verse 4, he's going to talk about the struggle. So, first of all, the struggle here does not necessarily refer to a personal struggle with sin. So, when you look at verse 4, he says, in your struggle against sin. That's not necessarily talking about a personal struggle with sin. It can, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. We're all in a struggle with sin. Is that not true in this world? Okay. So this will help. Okay. Striving against sin appears to reflect sinful people in verse 3. So when it's talking about striving against sin, it's talking about you living in a world with sinful people. All right? All right. So the writer states that his readers have not endured suffering to the point of death. So you ever met somebody who really is harassing you about what you believe? You ever met somebody who just mocks what you believe? I've worked with several guys through the years like that before I became a pastor. Still meet people like that. But I have to be honest with you, nobody's pulled out a gun yet and shot me. We've not suffered to the point of death. Would everybody agree with that? Okay? That's the point he's making here. But when he goes on to verses 5 through 11, he's going to talk about another aspect of difficulty that we face, and that's chastening. Now, what does chastening mean, George? Well, it means the woodshed. The woodshed. Whenever you've been told to go out to the woodshed by your daddy, he wasn't going to take you out there to give you an attaboy speech. He was going to take you out there to chasten you. What does that mean? To whoop you. Okay? Chastening means discipline. Okay, so here's what I want you to notice. So first of all, the writer points out that they, the readers, have forgotten the biblical exhortation concerning suffering. They've forgotten the reality of suffering. Now we're going to talk about this in the morning message when we get into the morning message. About that there is a level of suffering that we face that's consequences of our own actions because we give in to temptation. I think everybody recognizes that, right? We all have our stuff that we have to deal with, okay? So we have to deal with. I remember growing up, I lived in a neighborhood in Columbia. And, you know, my dad was in the Army, and so we lived outside in the suburbs of Columbia, And there was a sergeant that moved into the house next door, and he had a teenage girl. She was a little bit older than I is, but she had a car. And she just ran that car around until the engine blew up. And here, she never checked the oil. She never changed the oil. She didn't do anything. So whose fault was the blown up engine? Hers. Now who did she blame? Everybody else, her dad, that's exactly right. What kind of car did you buy me? But isn't that a human story there? You know what I'm saying? So he's saying you guys have forgotten the biblical exhortation concerning suffering. So then he says, the writer quotes Proverbs 3, verse 11 through 12, where the reader is called not to react to chastening. Not to react to discipline. So here's what I'm going to tell you right now. Jesus, you may think, is your buddy, but he will take you to the woodshed. Do you understand what I'm saying? We have this concept that Jesus is my buddy today. Yeah, but he may be a friend that sticks closer than a brother. But unlike some friends I have, he will discipline me. He will whoop me. Do you understand what I'm saying? And his whooping, I think I would rather take the whooping from my dad again. Do you understand what I'm saying? So what I'm trying to tell you is, this passage tells the reader that if they are children of God, they will be chastened. If you belong to the Lord, you will be chastened. I think we forget that now. We kind of have a come as you are, bring all your stuff, Jesus will love you, and you don't have to change anything. No, listen, God is holy. And if there's something displeasing in your life, he's going to what? He's going to change that, right? Isn't that what we did with our kids when they grew up, as we were trying to mold them into the young person they needed to be, you know? We disciplined them. So here's the response to chastening. We see it in verse 9. Chastening by our parents resulted in respect for our parents. There's a word for respect that we often don't use in our culture anymore, and that's fear. I feared my daddy. We're to fear God, right? Now, that fear is like, oh, were you terrified of him? Well, sometimes I was, if I really did something wrong. But the reality is I respected my dad because he had the authority to correct me, and I had to answer to. He was somebody I had to answer to. That's really the issue, isn't it? Somebody I had to answer to. That when we talk about the issue of fear here, you know, the reality is, the respect is because they have the authority. God has the authority in our lives. Now, here's what I want you to see. The writer asks if our chastening should not result in submission to God. He's saying, so when you get disciplined, shouldn't it result in you doing what he tells you to do? Look at verse 9. Here's what he says. Verse 9. Besides this, we have an earthly father who disciplined us and we respected him. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? Shall we not pay attention to what he's saying and do what he says and live? Okay, so here's what I want you to understand. I realized this many years ago. When God tells you not to do something, it's not because he's trying to be a cosmic killjoy. He's not trying to rule your life and make you miserable. He's actually trying to what? Protect you. Protect you. Protect you. From what? Other things that are out there that will destroy you, right? Destroy you. So then here's the purpose of chastening. Verse 10. Our parents disciplined us for a brief period as they knew best. And yeah, it is brief. You know, I have children now that are approaching 30. And I'm constantly being reminded as I talk with them, I can't talk with them like they're 5 anymore. Meaning dad tells them what to do. You know that doesn't work, right? There's a point where the discipline aspect ends with them, all right? So here's what he says. God disciplines us for our benefit so that we may be holy. The discipline with him doesn't end until one point. Does anybody know when the discipline ends? When we go to be with him. Yeah, when we're perfected. Until then, he's going to discipline us, okay? So here's the nature of the chastening, the nature of the discipline, verse 11. All chastening is painful for the moment. Would everybody agree with that? It's all painful for the moment. However, it produces the fruit of righteousness in those who are instructed by it. So it's going to produce something in your life. So think about it. If James chapter 1, verse 2 through 4. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Wow. All right. Next week, we're going to talk about the final warning that he's going to talk about in the latter part of chapter 12 in Hebrews.